You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
No doubt you've heard the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has released its second major report. This one is not about proving climate change is triggered by human emissions, nor does it suggest how to reduce those greenhouse gas pollutions of the atmosphere and the ocean. This report says climate change has arrived already and that further warming will occur. It tries to use science to outline who is most vulnerable to the coming impacts, where the greatest risks lie, and how humans can best adapt to changes in everything from rainfall to violent storms, rising seas, and a hotter world. The leaders of this group present very severe risks, but remain strangely optimistic that humans will find a way to manage them. They assume global governments will react to public pressure and find rational solutions. They assume that there will be effective global governance. In the press conference, co-chair of the Working Group 2, Chris Field, from the Carnegie Institute, still talked about making a better world, as did other speakers on the panel. Really? Let's go to my recording of the press conference held in Yokohama, Japan, on March 31, 2014. First, Dr. Michel Giraud of the World Meteorological Organization says we now have no excuse for ruining the planet. We cannot claim ignorance.
So I hope you realize that now we are at the point where we have so much information, so much evidence, we can no longer plead ignorance. 30 years ago, the previous generation maybe was damaging our atmosphere, the Earth, out of ignorance. Now ignorance is no longer a good excuse. We know. Therefore, we have the information to make decisions and to act upon this information. There may be still a few question marks. This should not be excuse not to act.
Now, I'm going to play you about 10 minutes from the presentation by co-chair Dr. Christopher Field, founding director of the Carnegie Institute Department of Global Ecology.
When you look at the key findings of the report, as Dr. Giraud and Dr. Pachauri have already said, one of the most important findings is that we're not in an era where climate change is some kind of a future hypothetical. We live in a world where impacts of climate changes that have already occurred are widespread and consequential. We see impacts from the equators to the poles and from the coast to the mountains. There's no question that we live in a world that's already altered by climate change. One of the most high-impact findings of this report is a map of where climate changes have occurred, where climate change impacts have occurred, what sectors have been affected, how confident are we in those changes, and what are the consequences of those changes. Here's a picture of the map, and I know it has too much detail for me to describe here, but you can think of this map as a portal, an entry point into a rich discussion of impacts that have already occurred, impacts that have occurred in the Americas, impacts that have occurred in the Southern Hemisphere, impacts in Asia, Europe, and Africa. Around the world, everywhere you look, there are impacts of climate changes that have already occurred, already been documented, and already had consequences. Here's an example. This is in the oceans, a new topic for Working Group 2 to address, but where there have been profound impacts, and looking across a large range of ocean organisms. This is a study pulling together data over 359 different species, and it's a map of the distances that species have moved as a consequence of the ocean warming that's already occurred. And you can see the distances on the left-hand scale, or in kilometers per decade, ranging up to over 400 kilometers per decade of movements toward cooler habitats that species have undergone as a consequence of the changes in their environment. Here's another example of changes that have already occurred, and this is the impact of climate change on large area food production, showing yields of wheat, soy, rice, and maize, with the average yield changes in recent decades as a consequence of climate change impacts shown as percent per decade. And you can see that for wheat and maize, there have already been significant decreases in the rate at which ag yields are able to increase climate change has been an anchor holding back progress in increasing ag yields. And though we haven't seen similar changes in rice and soy, we know from future projections that all crops are at risk of future warming. But in the case of observed impacts to date, we're already seeing them profoundly and to a large extent in two of the world's most important food crops, wheat and maize. A striking feature of the report is Dr. Pachauri has already emphasized, is that there are vulnerable people, societies, and ecosystems around the world. Much of the vulnerability is concentrated among the world's poor, but it's not only there. We see vulnerable ecosystems, people, and societies in the developed world as well. Wealth is not protection from vulnerability, but what you see is exposure and vulnerability unfold in different ways in different societies. The report has a lot of bad news in it. And it shows grave risks, but it also shows that people, societies, and governments are beginning to take steps to tackle those risks. Some of the steps were at the community scale. This is an image of local people planting mangroves to provide coastal protection in Tuvalu. Other kinds of adaptation that are already occurring are much more centered in technology and utilization of advanced engineering. This is a flood barrier in the Netherlands. It's another example of strategies that are already ongoing in order to provide protection, and much of the report is about how we're learning from the steps that are already being taken and how we can use this learning in order to raise ambitions for more successful and more comprehensive adaptation in the future. If there's a central theme to this Working Group 2 report, it's really that climate change is a challenge in managing risk. We know plenty about the climate changes that have already occurred and about the climate changes that are projected to make smart decisions. But we need to start making those decisions in the framework of managing risk, not in the framework of knowing, I expect a particular impact at a particular point, a particular time. We need to be thinking about reducing risk and building more resilient societies. Because one of the key findings in the assessment of future risks is that the more it warms, the greater those risks are. Increasing warming, increasing magnitudes of warming, increase the likelihood of severe and pervasive risks around the world, around the world's ecosystems, and across the world's communities. When you think about how to deal with those risks, we know a lot. And what we need to do is transform the realization of the risks into a platform for action. This is a conceptual diagram of the decision-making process that decision-makers around the world are already beginning to use in order to comprehensively confront the challenge to build on the information that's provided in the IPCC and similar assessments. Because there's no question that risks of climate change increase with continued high emissions. The challenge is how to deal with that through a comprehensive package that involves finding a smart mix of ways to decrease emissions, as will be explored in the Working Group 3 report, and adaptation, finding the best, most effective, most useful ways to cope with the climate changes that can't be avoided. Here's an example of a way to think about managing risks. The figure on the left-hand side shows historical temperatures and possible future temperatures through the 21st century for a world with continued high emissions, the pink banner, and a world with ambitious investments in mitigation, the blue banner. This is a figure from the Working Group 1 report. But it's positioned here next to a comprehensive analysis of reasons for concern that emerge from the Working Group 2 report. You can think of these reasons for concern as a distillation of all the impact elements, all the risk elements, and all the vulnerabilities into a focus on the kinds of things people care about for the future. What are the risks to global aggregate issues, things like total biodiversity, total economic activity? What are the risks to unique and threatened systems, the one-offs here, the unique species, the unique natural environment? What are the risks of extreme events and catastrophes, or what are the risks of large-scale singular events like the collapse of a continental ice sheet? And one of the things that's really important in the Working Group 2 analysis is a framework for thinking about these big-picture issues, these reasons for concern, individually and not needing to composite them all into a single metric of global risk, recognizing that different stakeholders in different places really do value things differently. And it's important to do that because the projections for the future really are grave. Here's an example of projections of future crop yields through the 21st century, and what the pairs of bars for each set of years show the studies projecting increased crop yields and the studies projecting decreased crop yields. Through the century, you can see that the studies projecting increased crop yields, the blue bars, get to be lower and lower and lower, and the studies projecting decreased crop yields, the brown bars, get to be taller and taller and taller, and darker and darker, so that by the end of the century, something like a quarter of the studies are projecting decreased crop yields of greater than 50%. That's the dark brown bar at the bottom of the rightmost bar. The risks to global food security are really profound and a really strong motivation, along with many others in the report, for making smart decisions to ensure that we have a world that can cope effectively with these problems. And that's really the bottom line from the whole report. The report talks a lot about challenges, and it has its share of scary scenarios and doom and gloom, but it also talks in a very optimistic tones, well, in neutral IPCC tones that are rich with optimism about the kinds of steps that are already being taken to deal as effectively as possible with the climate changes that can't be avoided, and the opportunities for integrating ambitious efforts to decrease climate change, to deal as effectively as we can with the climate changes that can't be avoided, into a comprehensive view of a society that's advancing, and taking advantage of steps to integrate climate change mitigation, climate change adaptation, and sustainable development into a vision of a better world, a richer that's more secure, more robust, and more vibrant. Thanks very much.
That was Dr. Chris Field speaking at the Yokohama press conference of the report by Working Group 2 of the IPCC on climate change risks and adaptation. As you heard, several lead authors remain optimistic we will somehow manage the risks of climate change, even as they conclude agricultural production could drop as much as 50% by the year 2100, that sea species are moving towards the poles, and even as human population increases by billions of people. At another point, they admit some scientists fear we are already entering the sixth great mass extinction. One source of their optimism is due to the assumptions in the reporting process. Pressed by a reporter in the Q&A period, Dr. Field admits they did not consider global warming beyond 2 degrees, and that's because they had no dependable science to predict such a scenario. Here is part of that exchange.
The important key to the numbers is that the number we present for the global aggregate economic impact is more or less the sort of linear deterministic approach to the impacts that might hit the economy at a warming of around 2 degrees, kind of the warming level you might get with ambitious mitigation. That's the residual impacts, those are the ones we have to adapt to anyhow. The number that you would like to have, what would be the impact of the global economy at warming level without mitigation, with continued high emissions, we don't present because we think that it's sort of beyond the capability of the linear traditional economic approaches to describe that. And so therefore, the way we present the issue of avoided impacts, the difference between the unmitigated and the residual, is in terms of reducing the risks, especially to these five key reasons for concern, of which the global aggregate damage is an important one, but it's not necessarily the most important. The distribution of impacts, the threats to rare and endangered systems, the risks of unique large-scale issues like a collapse of a global ice sheet, and the distributional are all equally important. And we certainly wouldn't want anyone to come away from this report thinking that it's appropriate to do a simple, traditional cost-benefit analysis comparing unmitigated impacts with costs of adaptation. That should be a part of it, but it's important to recognize that the numbers we present are not that. They're the numbers that are much closer to thinking about residual impacts. Those are the impacts that we have to deal with regardless of how effective we are with mitigation.
Rajendra Pachauri of the IPCC.
Yeah, let me just add to that. I think quite apart from the economic costs, which can be and have been estimated through conventional means, we mustn't forget the fact that there's a large amount of impacts which you really cannot monetize easily. And in fact, in our special report on extreme events and disasters, we said specifically that loss estimates are lower bound estimates because many impacts, such as loss of human lives, cultural heritage, and ecosystem services, are difficult to value and monetize. And there's also a large undocumented economy in several parts of the world. Now, that gets disrupted with the impacts of climate change. But it doesn't feature, I mean, that loss doesn't feature anywhere in any of our formal systems that measure economic output.
Also, we recall that every word of the IPCC report has to be approved by consensus by all world governments. Of course, it's going to be political and sound good and watered down despite this feel-good approach by Dr. Rajendra Pachauri.
And therefore, I would say that all of this will become apparent, and I trust human society would give us justification for the optimism that Dr. Chris Field has articulated.
Now, I've got to be fair here. Dr. Pachauri was the most realistic in his other assessments of our predicament, and I regret we don't have time to run more of what he said.
We have reasons to believe that if the world doesn't do anything about mitigating the emissions of greenhouse gases and the extent of climate change continues to increase, then the very social stability of human systems could be at stake.
Pachauri warned that if we cannot reduce emissions soon, the whole of human society is in grave danger. Considering emissions have continued to rise despite more than 20 years of IPCC reports, it's hard to know where he finds even guarded optimism. Is this part of a culture of hopium at the point where science interfaces with governments? But what happens if we do go beyond 2 degrees? At least we get a few hints in this reply by Dr. Chris Field in the Q&A session at Yokohama.
There's the possibility of very large impacts with big producing regions not being appropriate for continued investment in agriculture. And as Dr. Giroux says, you know, that the issue with extremes is often not whether you get one or two extremes that produces a shock in the global price system. It's whether the extremes occur so frequently that it's not worth doing agriculture in an area. And I think that most of the analyses of large-scale shifts in where we might be growing crops have to do more with the frequency of conditions that push areas down below continued, let's say, sustainable or profitable operations. A second really big area of concern in these large-scale impacts is losses to biodiversity. One of the areas where the reporting in the AR5 is different than in the AR4 is the fraction of species at risk of extinction from climate change. The AR4 provided some very preliminary numbers indicating that something like 30% of species might be at risk of extinction from a modest amount of climate change. And the wording has shifted in the AR5 to indicate a very large fraction of species. We don't know what it is, but a very large fraction likely to be at risk of extinction from the combination of climate change interacting with all the other stressors that are impacting the Earth system, such that many scientists have argued we may already be either on the threshold or over the threshold of a sixth mass extinction in Earth's history. And then a final area that I want to highlight is really important is it's described in the reasons for concern as singular events. And the one that should be most on people's mind is commitment to loss of a major continental ice sheet like the Greenland ice sheet, which has enough mass of ice sitting above sea level that if that melts, we're talking about 7 meters approximately of global sea level rise. And there's some point in the future at which the climate system is essentially committed to complete loss of the Greenland ice sheet. We don't know if that occurs at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial or 3 degrees above pre-industrial, but there's some point at which we'll pass a threshold for this, at least on the time scale of centuries to thousands of years, irreversible large-scale change in the Earth system with a commitment to meters of sea level rise.
In a couple of weeks, we'll have another brief round of media attention as Working Group 3 releases their report on how to cut emissions. For one day, and one day only, the words climate change will again make the Google list of top story topics in the news. Considering we risk our future and the whole ecosphere, should it not be a permanent fixture there instead of the Kardashians or maybe the latest juicy murder story? But that's another world. This newest IPCC report is an improvement over past reports. It has more current reporting. It's more blunt about the challenges we are facing, if you read between the lines. Even in its watered-down form, it should be taught in every classroom in the world, starting next week. But who can tell the children what we try so hard to hide from ourselves? I suggest you spend an hour of your life to watch the IPCC press conference in Yokohama on YouTube. A few thousand people have done it. It's much less popular than cat videos, but it's easy to search for it or find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, working for you, the listener, and maybe for some other species who cannot speak for themselves.